Welcome all to this episode of the Review of Democracy podcast. I'm Alexander Medzibrotsky, guest editor, and it is a great pleasure to have with us today Una Bergmane to discuss her book, Politics of Uncertainty, the United States, the Baltic Question, and the Collapse of the Soviet Union. First of all, I'm very happy to welcome you, Una, today here. Thank you for accepting our invitation.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
So before we start discussing your book, let me introduce you a bit to our listeners. Una Bergmane's main research interest is the history of the Soviet collapse, the Baltic states, diasporas, transnational networks, collective memory, and the post-Cold War transitions in the Baltic Sea region. She's currently an Academy of Finland research fellow at the Aleksanteri Institute in Helsinki. Before joining the Institute, she held various fellowships across the world. She was a postdoctoral fellow at Cornell University in the United States, a teaching fellow at the London School of Economics, and a postdoctoral researcher at the Academy of Finland-funded Baltrans project. She obtained her PhD from Sciences Po in Paris. So the focus of our podcast today is Una's first book, which was published by Oxford University Press this year in 2023. As already mentioned, the title of the book is Politics of Uncertainty, the United States, the Baltic Question, and the Collapse of the Soviet Union. In a nutshell, the book tells the story of how Cold War superpowers tried to deal with the Baltic Question at the end of the 1980s, but also how marginal actors can find strategies to gain recognition and visibility on the international stage during periods of deep historical change. So let's have a closer look at the ideas and arguments of your book. My first question is related to this important term included in your subtitle as well, the Baltic Question. So could you please a little bit explain, summarize what the Baltic Question is? I was also wondering maybe what makes the Baltics a special, a different case from other regions such as Central Europe or other Soviet peripheries?
Yeah, thank you very much. So this is a great question, which goes right at the heart of my research. So the Baltic question, why the Baltic countries were to some extent different, or what happened to them was different from what happened to Central Eastern European countries during the Cold War, or how they were different from other Soviet republics. So in the Baltic case, they were independent between the two world wars, between 1918, when they proclaimed their independence, and 1940. And so when in 1940, so first in 1939, we have the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and the secret protocols that divide Eastern Europe in the Russia and the Soviet and Nazi zone of influence. And so then, as a consequence of these secret protocols, the Soviet Union first occupies and then illegally annexes the Baltic countries in the summer of 1940. But at that moment, in the summer of 1940, first, the United States, and then most of the Western countries do not recognize this annexation of the Baltic countries by the Soviet Union as legal. And that continues. So then the Baltic countries are occupied by the Nazis during the Second World War. And then the Red Army comes back and at the same time liberates and reoccupies the Baltic countries again. And so then during the Cold War, practically, the Baltic countries are part of the Soviet Union, but legally, because of this non-recognition policy, which is similar to what we see today. So today, we do not recognize the annexation of Crimea by Russia as legal. We do not recognize the annexation of eastern parts of Ukraine by Russia as legal. And so the same idea is behind this non-recognition policy towards the Baltic countries during the Cold War. And so for the West during the Cold War, that is the Baltic question. This situation when three out of 15 Soviet republics are legally not part of the Soviet Union in the eyes of the West.
Thank you. I think that clearly highlights why there is a story here to tell. I also wanted to a little bit discuss your approach to this subject matter in terms of you mentioned while writing the book, you wanted to avoid reproducing imperial and strictly national narratives and perspectives. And I was wondering, why did you choose this approach? How conscious it was and how difficult it was to weave such a transnational narrative? And you also highlight this is a regional story embedded in domestic and international politics and dynamics. And I think that comes up a lot in terms of looking at the dynamics And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit also as well, how do you distinguish between the international and the domestic? As I felt in your narrative, often they feel like the two sides of the same coin. For instance, just to highlight what I'm talking about, how the Baltic question, as you explained, would be for the US by default a foreign policy issue. But because of certain circumstances, like the Baltic diaspora, it can be also looked at as an internal political issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. No, that is exactly how I see this research, this interrelated research between domestic and international politics, that these are two sides of the same coin. But if we look actually at how this time period between mid-80s, late-90s is written and researched, then these historiographies, in terms of historiography, these often are two more or less separated topics, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. And somehow Gorbachev's foreign policy is treated separately, often not always, from his domestic policies. And then especially if we think about the negotiations about German unification or foreign policy of George Bush, these are topics that are discussed by historians writing about the end of the Cold War. But when we write about the collapse of the Soviet Union, these issues are not really integrated in this narrative. But I really very strongly felt, and in general, I think that good international history can be written only when we understand the domestic roots of the external action. And then when we write about domestic dynamics, again, we can understand these domestic dynamics better if we contextualize these domestic dynamics with larger trends in the region or internationally. And this is also something I wanted to write to do when it came to independence of the Baltic states. Because again, if you look at the current historiography, there are these two extremes. Either you have things written about the end of the Cold War from the perspective of Washington and Moscow, the two superpowers and the decision makers. And it's not that often that people look at smaller actors like France or, well, Germany, but then smaller states don't really have a place in these narratives. And again, if we think about the collapse of the Soviet Union, again, everything more or less, with few notable exceptions, but more or less everything is written from the perspective of Moscow. Soviet collapse is narrated through the perspective of Moscow. So this is this one imperial approach where everything is Moscow-centered. And then the other extreme, this national approach, which you see in the three Baltic countries, that very often people write, let's say, about the independence of Latvia, as Latvia was this isolated island that somehow managed to make its way out of the Soviet Union. So this purely national perspective. And what I wanted really to do in the book was to write about the Baltic push for independence as regional story. It was a regional Baltic effort. And of course, there were national differences and national particularities. But actually, if we look at these events, then it is very visible, very obvious that what we see in the archives, that at that time, internationally or domestically in the Soviet Union, there is not such a thing as like a single Latvian, Estonian or Lithuanian question. There is the Baltic question, which is a bit more a Lithuanian question because Lithuanians are more active and more bold in their approach to their struggle for independence. But the understanding both in the Baltic countries, in Moscow, in the US, it is exactly this, that either all of the Baltic countries will become independent or none of them will. So it made sense to have this regional perspective to write about this Baltic way towards the re-establishment of their independence as this joint effort, which was then embedded in these larger dynamics of the end of the Cold War and also the Soviet collapse. And yes, as you said, it's the foreign and domestic policy really is two sides of the same coin. For the Americans, as you mentioned, it is an international question, obviously, but it's also a domestic issue because the diaspora, Baltic diaspora, is there and because the Congress has very strong links with the diaspora, and so they put pressure on Bush. And for Gorbachev, it becomes, he doesn't want this to be a foreign policy issue, but it becomes because of the Baltic active outreach, because of the non-recognition policy, the fact that the annexation of the Baltic states was not recognized as legal in 1940, the international society is forced to be interested in this question. And so for Gorbachev, it becomes not just a domestic international question. And for the Baltic countries, it's really, there is no clear distinction between domestic and foreign policies at that time, because the struggle for independence is this, at the same time, domestic mobilization and external action towards Moscow and then towards the larger international society, the West, the United States, and so on and so forth. So yeah, and in principle, I think that if we want to write a good international history, we have to be able to explain the domestic roots of these international politics. And if we want to write a good domestic history, we need at the same time to be able to put these domestic dynamics in a larger regional, international context.
Yeah, thank you. I think you clearly explained why it's imperative to bring together these two aspects, international and the domestic, to arrive at a full or fuller picture and story, and why this is told as a regional story in your book. And I like that you already reflected on sort of the role of Baltic peoples and agency in how to change these dynamics as well. And we are going to talk about it a little bit more. But before that, for my next question, I wanted a little bit to zoom in on one particular concept and term that is key in your narrative. So you call this, quote, a time of deep historical change that you are looking at in your book, and you highlight how this turbulent period disrupted the existing power structures and created uncertainty. So this would be the term and the concept I'm really interested in. It's of course featured in the title of your book as well, Politics of Uncertainty. And as you're reading the book, quite correctly, you do feel this uncertainty coming up again and again. And there did not seem to be much coherent plans in the mind of the actors that you are looking at on all sides. But I also, a little bit to challenge this, felt that you are also quite adeptly showing that there was some logic to how certain actors decided what to do, what not to do. So just to mention, you identify some red flags. For instance, the use of force by the Soviets would not have been acceptable by the US, or some pressure points like the Soviet-American trade agreement. So if you could a little bit talk about, you know, what is the role of and the function of uncertainty in your narrative? And despite these sort of guiding frameworks, you do, I think, highlight, why did you feel that still uncertainty is such a core to the politics of this time?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, so the main idea in the book is that at the time of this deep historical change, these existing power structures are disrupted by the political, social change happening, international change happening at that time, not just in the Soviet Union, but by consequence, because of the change in the Soviet Union, also in Europe. And so the fact that these kind of very stable Cold War systems and dynamics, because they disappear or they start to, they are deeply modified, this leaves the actors, such as, for example, the White House, in really uncharted waters, because they know how to deal with the Soviet Union in the Cold War setting. They know how to deal with an authoritarian Soviet or even totalitarian Soviet Union. And that's something that the Americans have been working on how to deal with this type of Soviet Union since, 1945, the origins of the Cold War. And now this is the big question, what to do with Gorbachev. And Reagan and Bush, they actually don't have, Bush comes in power after when he is elected with the idea that Reagan has been too soft on Gorbachev. And there is a huge distrust initially in the White House, in Bush administration, regarding Gorbachev. Can we trust him? If we can trust him, is he really a real reformer, or are these just like nice images for the West, but actually the Soviet Union is not going to change? And then when they realize that probably, yes, they can't actually trust this is really a reformer, not somebody who has tricked Reagan into believing in this, then the big question is, okay, but can he survive politically? How is he going to handle the power struggle in the Soviet Union? What does this power struggle in the Soviet Union mean for the United States? And then at some point at the White House, you also see a realization that probably this country is slowly disintegrating. And the uncertainty is the question, what to do with possible Soviet disintegration? how to handle it. And there is no answer. And that is the big general uncertainty that the United States don't know what to do about this. At the same time, of course, there are some, and in this big, general confusion, the White House tries to have some sort of like guidelines. In this is not the answer. These guidelines are not an answer to what to do with the Soviet collapse or what to do with Soviet power struggle. But there are some ideas that, yes, for example, we should not allow Gorbachev to use force in the Baltic countries, because if that happens, that might be the end of perestroika. Because one of the big questions is also, would Gorbachev use force, and would that mean the end of perestroika? And if that's the end of perestroika, then do we still need Gorbachev? Because the whole idea that Gorbachev is interesting as long as he is democratic and a reformer. But the same thing happens in Moscow. We see this general uncertainty in Moscow, because there was a vision, Gorbachev had a vision of this new reformed Soviet Union that would achieve great things, but there really wasn't a plan of how to handle these social forces that were unleashed by the democratization. That suddenly, this whole Soviet system was built around this asymmetric power relation between the center and the periphery, and at the same time for this authoritarian frame, in which the Moscow would have the final say on everything that happened in the Soviet Union. But then because of the democratization, suddenly there is something that Moscow has never seen before, this increasingly democratic, increasingly pluralistic, and increasingly active periphery, especially in the Baltic countries. And Gorbachev just does not know what to do with the Baltic countries or with the center-periphery relation in general. And thus the uncertainty, because these previous authoritarian imperial power structures are either shifting or falling apart. But then in this context, the marginal actors, those who actually have not benefited from previously existing power structures, such as the Baltic countries, those who want to challenge the system, those who want to kind of climb up in these hierarchies, for them, this is a good time because they can now use this window of opportunity to put the question of their independence on the Soviet domestic agenda and on the international agenda.
Mm-hmm. Great. I think this is nicely leading to my next question, and a little bit sort of moving our direction exactly towards more marginalized actors, and in particular the Baltic people, who are also very much in the focus of your book. So it was very interesting for me that Baltic peoples perceive themselves quite differently from how they were perceived, or rather misperceived, by Moscow as, quote, a relatively rich and a relatively calm part of the USSR. And you highlight how, sort of because of this misperception, the re-emergence of the Baltic question seemed sudden for Moscow. But you also clearly show that, of course, this was not a sudden new phenomenon. But basically what's behind it is that Soviet leaders completely failed to understand the depth and the seriousness of the grievances in the Baltics. So I thought that was a very interesting part of your book. So could you a little bit shed more light, talk a bit more about sort of the sources of these grievances in the Baltics, whether they were different from the three countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and how did these were translated into action, or how they impacted action by Baltic actors? And why were the Soviet leaders so blind, so incapable of seeing the signs of these deep grievances?
Yes, so Gorbachev's problem was this hierarchical system that existed in the Soviet Union. I'm not the first one, or not the last one to say this. This is not somehow my bright idea, but there is this argument in the historiography that the Soviet nationality policies, and that started already in the 30s, but then later after the Second World War, it was even more visible, that you would basically have a hierarchy of these ethnicities and nationalities in the Soviet Union. And of course, the Russian elder brother would be at the top of this hierarchy. And then all the other nationalities would be somehow organized. And the perception was very Eurocentric and also to some extent racist, that these Western parts, well, the Slavic, of course, but then also the Baltic, those Western parts were somewhere upper, higher in these ethnic hierarchies. And then the Central Asian parts would be in the lower parts of these hierarchies, or the indigenous nations in the north of Russia. would be really deeply marginalized because they didn't were not positioned in this collective imaginary as Western or as Russian, or they didn't have this potential to be Russianized, as for example in the case of Ukrainians. So, and the Baltics, they were, because of their geographical situation, because of their race, because of the also the fact that these were parts of the Soviet Union that became later part of the Soviet Union only in 1940 and then 1945. So these were well-developed states that already had infrastructure and everything. And so that's they were perceived as the civilized part of the Soviet Union by the collective imaginary of the many Soviet citizens. And Gorbachev was influenced by this. And so somehow he thought that, well, these are places where people want to migrate from all around the Soviet Union. These are attractive tourist destinations that the cities look like in the West, and they, the products they produce are sold everywhere in the Soviet Union, and they are some sort of a status symbols. So he somehow started to believe in this narrative, this false narrative about Baltic life being somehow good and nice in the Soviet Union. And because he believed this, he also didn't really look very carefully. He visited the Baltic countries and he believed what the communists were showing him, the happy people giving him flowers. But the reality, and he didn't really have also somebody around him with a deep expertise in the region that could explain that actually these societies were very unsettled and troubled by their experience under the Soviet rule. And the things that were troubling the Baltic societies, there were some that were very common in the Soviet Union. The memories of Stalin's repressions, of the deportations, the nationality policy, which on one hand enforced some form of regulated national identity, but at the same time deprived this national identity from any political meaning or political agency, rather to say. Collapsing Soviet economy was a problem for everybody in the Soviet Union. The problems in the environment, especially after Chernobyl. The traumatizing experience of the Soviet version of modernity. Urbanization was very painful in Lithuania, or I don't know, collectivization was painful everywhere. So all these problems were kind of shared in the Soviet Union. But like, I think the difference in the Baltic countries was why were they were the first who said that the solution to all these problems is independence. That was simply because there was this memory of independence. People who were alive in the end of the 1930s, when Baltic countries lost their independence, many of them were still alive in the 80s. So there was a generation of this living memory, or those were children of those people who lived in independent Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And so there was the idea of that there is an alternative, which is independence, and that there is an alternative also in terms of like democratic experience that Baltic countries had to some extent in the interwar period. That the Soviet reality is not the only reality that is possible. And then, of course, the geographical situation was beneficial because, and especially in the Estonian case, it kind of gave the possibility to, well, this is a classical example, but Estonians were in the north, were able to watch Finnish television, and they were able to understand the language quite easily. And then there were these historical ties with Sweden or with Germany. And then, of course, in 1989, when the Velvet Revolutions happened all around the Eastern Europe, the Baltic countries, to some extent, because they had these historical ties with Poland, they saw themselves, to some extent, as being part of this Eastern Europe. Not the Soviet Union, but historically, because of their history, they somehow saw themselves that, well, this concerns also them, that if all these changes are possible in Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, then they should be possible also in the Baltic countries. So yes, geography played an important role, and also the ideas about the historical ties and cultural connections and all of that.
Yes, I think as an intellectual historian, I'm always fascinated how much what you can imagine sort of shapes what you see, right, in the case of Gorbachev, and also what you do in the case of the Baltics. And I would like to a little bit discuss more the agency of the Baltics people and sort of a recurring theme in your narrative. We now discussed a little bit the hierarchies of nationalities, which was also an important sort of domestic aspect in your analysis. But you also talk a lot about the power hierarchies, and you already mentioned, right, that because of this deep historical change and this uncertainty that limits the agency of the powerful and opens windows of opportunity for those seen as marginal. So you have that part. But also, I think, and that played into some of the sort of techniques and strategies of Baltic actors, you analyzed the hierarchy of self-determination claims and how it motivated and shaped American and Soviet reactions to the Baltic push for independence. So could you talk a bit more about the agency and the dynamics between those on the top of domestic and international power structures and those on the margins, as this is very much in the focus of your analysis? And maybe, you know, what were some of the tools and strategies of the marginalized actors to achieve social visibility and recognition in the international arena? And why was this so important in relation to the independence movement?
Yeah, so the international visibility was very important for the Baltic independence movements. And this idea of visibility as a recognition. And the recognition, of course, it was a legal recognition that the Baltic countries were looking for to be recognized, that their re-establishment of their independence would be legally recognized by the international community. And the Baltic idea was about how this was supposed to go. They believed that, well, if the international community will legally recognize the restoration of Baltic independence, then Gorbachev will just have to abide with that, and that will be the end of it. The Americans and most of the Western countries thought that they can recognize the Baltic country, the re-establishment of the Baltic countries, only after it has been recognized by Gorbachev. Because at the end of the day, Gorbachev was the one who had the power, military power and economic power, to coerce Baltic countries into staying in the Soviet Union. And the Baltic countries obviously found this disappointing. And they were also looking for this kind of existential recognition, and in this sense the visibility was to be recognized as visible, as being seen. This is something that marginalized actors, let's say in domestic politics, socially marginalized actors, when they become or self or at the time of self-organization, this is one of the first aims of social movements: to be recognized, to be seen, to be acknowledged. And the sentiment in the Baltic countries was kind of similar. They wanted to be recognized as being something different than the other Soviet republics. They wanted to be seen as being different from Russians. And that was important in this context, when in the Soviet context, Russians were this elder brother at the top of these ethnic national hierarchies. They wanted to be recognized as being part of Europe. To some extent, they also, they saw the international environment as some sort of a hierarchical setting in which being European was the highest prize, and they wanted to be recognized with this highest prize of being European. So these were very important questions, and just to be recognized as being themselves and existing. And that was important, especially for Estonians and Latvians, because at the end of the 80s, the situation in Estonia and Latvia was quite concerning for people at the time, because of the migration from other Russian-speaking republics. And the migration as such was not the problem, because Estonia and Latvia has always been these multinational societies. But the problem was the scope of the migration. By the end of the 80s, Latvians had almost become a minority in Latvia. So there was a fear in Latvia that if they become a minority in Latvia, then Latvia would not probably be a union republic anymore. Then it would be autonomous republic or something like that. So that was a concern. And then, of course, in the Soviet setting, people who arrived in the Baltic countries in the Soviet period, they were not encouraged to kind of embrace the local cultures or to learn the local languages. They were encouraged to claim this imperial privilege, which the Russian language had. And so there was this fear, and not just in the Baltic countries. If you read the Soviet press at the end of the 80s, there is this general fear in the Soviet Union that small nations, small languages will somehow disappear. And thus, there was this idea, which my Estonian colleague Karel Pirma has highlighted quite a lot, this idea in the Baltic countries that these are existential politics. These are existential questions, whether we become independent and thus survive, or there will be some sort of a turn towards full Russification over time. And in that context, this idea that you are recognized as being Estonian by other Europeans and you are being recognized as Latvian or Lithuanian, and there is this external other, this European other, who says, yes, you exist, you are different, and you have the right to be part of this European community.
Yes, thank you. I saw this, yeah, this existential element was really fascinating, and it also showed me why it was so relentless, the actors in the Baltics, then the push for independence. So there are so many things we could talk about this book, but my final question would be a little bit about the larger implications of your research results. So how does your research feed into larger historiographical discussions and debates, maybe in Russian and Soviet studies or in international relations? How could it influence our more general understanding of perestroika and the collapse of the USSR? Do you think this specific Baltic case study maybe can offer relevant insights also on how smaller states and marginalized actors can navigate the muddy waters of big power relations and achieve their goals and, you know, have some impact in this area? And maybe finally, would you say that a transnational, a regional approach that you have in your book may be helpful when it comes to the question, to the very topical question of how to decolonize scholarship in this research area?
Yeah, well, I believe that is absolutely the case, that if we want to decolonize whatever we want to decolonize, the Soviet studies, the studies of the Russian Empire, Soviet Empire, if we want to think about the collapse of the Soviet Union in a decolonial way, then it is quite important to do what I was trying to do with the book, to see, for example, the Soviet collapse, not just from the point of view of Moscow, but from the perspective of the so-called periphery or these non-Russian republics. The Russian attitudes toward the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's an important question for many reasons, but it is a question that has been quite a lot studied. So we have some idea about the Yeltsin's politics, Gorbachev's politics, but then the impact that these policies had in other parts of the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union did not collapse only in Moscow. The Soviet Union collapsed everywhere where the Soviet Union was, in the Baltic countries, in Central Asia, in Armenia, Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, and so on and so forth. And I think it's very important to study and to compare these processes in different parts of these non-Russian republics. And also how, as I said, these asymmetrical power relations between Moscow and these different republics, how they were transformed, challenged. In some places, maybe they remained the same. Maybe in some place of the Soviet Union, the local elites were actually unsettled by these possible changes because they were benefiting from the Soviet system. So all these questions are very important to be studied, and then we can compare how these processes took place in different parts of the Soviet Union. And this question of the external outreach also has to be taken seriously. So, for example, Serhiy Plokhii has written before me, he wrote his book, The Last Empire, where he basically studies the Ukrainian question in American-Soviet relations, just like I study the Baltic question. And if we compare these two cases, we can come to very interesting conclusions. For example, about these hierarchies, as Serhiy Plokhii writes, what was allowed for the Baltic countries was not allowed for Ukraine. So there was an idea that, well, Baltic countries probably could become independent. And that was seen as a legitimate demand in the US, while Ukrainian independence was not seen as a legitimate demand in the US. That is just one comparison. Or, for example, Isaac Scarborough just published his book, I think it's called Moscow's Heavy Shadow. And his argument is that there were parts of the Soviet Union where the Soviet collapse was actually very violent. And that is, again, something that, yes, we see this in the Baltic countries, the Soviet attempts to use violence. And he writes about the violent collapse of the Soviet Union in Tajikistan, which is something that if we read all these sources from St. Petersburg or Moscow, we don't see this violent and deeply tragic part of the Soviet collapse. So yes, if we want to fully understand the Soviet Union as such and its legacies and what is happening today in the region, then we have to look at what happened in all the places where the Soviet power was present, not just at the center of the of the at the heart of the power.
Yes, I think that's a great concluding thought there. So I think we managed to cover many of the main points in your book. But of course, I want to highlight that the depth and the richness of your book and narrative is so much more. So I encourage our listeners to actually read and read more about the details and the, you know, anecdotes and all the archival materials that you unearthed for this book. Actually, we have a little bit of time. I wanted to ask you, do you want to say just a couple of sentences maybe about your book has been published? Do you have any research in progress or in planning?
Yes, the new project that I'm working on at the University of Helsinki at Alexandra Institute, which is the Finnish Center for Eastern European and Russian Studies. The new project is still about the collapse of the Soviet Union, but this time I want to look still at this transnational perspective, but a bit more focused on the dynamics inside the Soviet borders, even though, as I said, this transnational question is also important. And so what I'm interested in is debates about history of the Soviet Union, debates that took place at the time of perestroika. Because at the time of perestroika, because of democratization, because of the increasing freedom of speech, which came with Gorbachev's reforms, we see everywhere in the Soviet Union groups of activists becoming more and more present in the public space and telling a different story about the history of the Soviet Union than the official version. A very strong example, which is also one of my case studies that I want to look at, are the Crimean Tatars. And they are probably the best example to look at these processes. There have been Crimean Tatar activists for a very long time in the Soviet Union, but this mass mobilization, it really starts at the time of perestroika, and this very strong activism first to talk about the deportations of Crimean Tatars during the war, and then as a consequence to claim the possibility to return to Crimea. And this is very inspiring for in the Baltic countries, other parts of the Soviet Union. And so this is the beginning of these, as I said, this activism by different groups in different parts of the Soviet Union, people basically telling a different story than the official story. And what I'm interested in this process is first the connections between these groups. I start from the Baltic vantage point, but then I look at what were the connections that the Baltic activists had with other non-Russian republics, with Russians, with Memorial. But at the same time, the bigger question is to what extent did these honest discussions about Soviet history contributed to the delegitimization of the Soviet power. Because yes, at the time, Khrushchev, and that was also initially Gorbachev's idea, that we should talk a little bit about history, basically in a framework where Stalin is the main and only perpetrator and the Communist Party is the first victim. That was Khrushchev's approach, and that was initially what also Gorbachev wanted to do. He was really willing to do the rehabilitation of all the big political trials and victims who were members of the Communist Party, like Bukharin, for example. He was very willing to talk about Bukharin, but not that willing to talk about Crimean Tatars. And so then these discussions go out of hand, and there is this honest, deep discussion about the extent and the diversity of the victims, and that the victims were not just prominent members of the Communist Party. Those were not just the so-called class enemies, but then also it turns out those were entire ethnic groups. And that's what I want to see with my research. What was the impact that these discussions had on the legitimacy of the Soviet state in the eyes of the Soviet citizens?
Well, as a historian by training, I'm already super interested in your next project. And I'm sure the same way as the book we have discussed today, your next project will also help us to better understand all these, as you mentioned, better understand the Soviet collapse. So, Una, thank you for this fascinating talk today. In this episode, we have been discussing Una Bergmanen's book entitled Politics of Uncertainty, the United States, the Baltic Question, and the Collapse of the Soviet Union. I believe our discussion highlighted the complexity of how Cold War superpowers, the Soviet Union and the USA, tried to deal with the Baltic question at the end of the 1980s, But we also got a fuller picture of the agency of the people in the Baltics. And I truly believe that this volume makes an important contribution for our better understanding of the Soviet collapse and perestroika period. And as you mentioned, there's so much more to research about this question, and I'm sure it will inspire the book further studies that aim to expand the focus beyond the Cold War superpower dynamics. So thank you again, Una, for being with us today. And also thank you all for listening this episode of the Review of Democracy podcast.
Yes, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.